Bay, and we look forward to joining us for our junior shiur and the next shiur that we're going to be having throughout the week and on May 19th after Shavuot.
Thank you so much, Rabbi. Thank you very much for the warm welcome, and as always, thank you for giving me the opportunity to learn with Zichron Yisrael. I do miss being able to learn together in person. I do not miss learning together at 2:15. Usually 2:15 is right after scampering up Atkinson from the Bayit, from the 1 a.m. shear, and that brings challenges. So this, you know, my basement's a little more comfortable than that. I'm a little more awake than that, and hopefully the result will be some strong learning. As well, I want to echo Rabbi Grisman's comments about Yom Yerushalayim. This is, you know, it was an exhausting Yom Yerushalayim to begin with, after Meron and after so many other things that have happened in the past month, and COVID, and then the way things have developed today, you know, very, very scary. And I join the thought that we should learn and we should daven for Shalom Yerushalayim, for the welfare of Yerushalayim and of Israel in general. I also want to note, and I put it at the top of the source sheet, I'm going to put the link for the source sheet in the chat again, that this shiur is dedicated in honor of Andy Gann's 75th birthday by his loving family. I wasn't sure if the birthday was today or not, but I see the balloon hovering behind you. So that means it either happened already or it's happening today, I assume. Mazel tov, and you should merit many, many, many more years of health and simcha and learning. Okay, so we're going to talk Megillat Rut, and I actually see one person here who was in a shiur that I gave on Sunday. Rabbi Metzger with our Beit Midrash was going to give a shiur on Sunday for Bnei Torah. His wife gave birth early, Baruch Hashem, and as a result, he couldn't give the shiur on Sunday, and I filled in for him and borrowed from what I'm going to be doing with you this evening. So there's one person here who already had a preview, which is just fine, because I love the idea that I'm going to be presenting, and honestly, if I could give this shiur three or four times, I would, because I really like what we're going to be doing, with this. I'm going to be assuming some familiarity with the basic story of Megillat Rut. It's a short book. It's 85 sentences. If you take a look on the sheet, and again, the link for the sheet is in the chat, you will see an outline that I gave you, courtesy of Professor Feivel Meltzer. Professor Meltzer is the editor of the Dot Mikra edition of Megillat Rut. I don't know if any of you know his background, but he was the son of Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, a major, major halachic authority in Israel, decades ago. His sister was married to, I think, Rav Aaron Cutler, either Rav Aaron Cutler or Schneur Cutler, and Professor Meltzer was a professor of Bible, wrote quite a brilliant commentary to Megillat Rut, and here he gives you just a brief outline of the events in the book. So we start out with Naomi and Elimelech and their sons Mahlon and Kilion, making the trip from Beit Lechem off to Moab at a time of famine in the land of Israel. A lot of discussion about why they go and what's wrong with what they do, but I'm not discussing that right now. And they live in Moab. Elimelech dies. Mahlon and Kilion marry two local women, Rut and Arpah. And then Mahlon and Kilion die. And then Naomi hears the famine has ended. They come back to Beit Lechem. Everybody is shocked at the way Naomi has descended in status. She had been wealthy. She had a wonderful family. Now it's her with her two Moabite daughters-in-law. Actually, one Moabite daughter-in-law, because Arpah remains. They come back to the land. And then in chapter 2, it's the harvest season. Ruth goes gleaning. Chapter 3, Ruth asks Boaz to marry her and redeem the field that Naomi owned. It's obviously a little bit more elaborate than that. And then finally in chapter 4, Boaz marries Ruth, redeems the field, they have a baby, and that leads to King David. That's your brief outline of the story. Much more to be read in there. I've actually been teaching Ruth for the last couple of months, and there's a lot more to be said about it. I see actually a couple of people here who have been in that shiur. So Ruth is a remarkable book to learn, and to learn properly. First of all, it's an action story. I call your attention to source number 2 on the sheet. A midrash that points out that each of the 85 verses in the book of Ruth begins with a letter Vav, with and, except for 8 sentences. And Professor Meltzer notes that the other 8 sentences are in dialogue. They're in the middle of a dialogue. So they don't start with and. But other than that, it's and. Tell me something. What's the significance of starting with and? Starting all these sentences with and. What does that telegraph to you?
Something happened.
I'm sorry, what is he?
Something happened before it.
Something happened before it. Yep, that's for sure true. It's a connecting word. What else? By the way, folks, just to let you know, I'm not recording video, so please, everyone is welcome to turn on their video. It makes for a much better learning experience for me when I'm able to see people.
It's just continuity of the story.
It's continuity of the story. It's action. Right? It's action. This happened, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened. Everything is flowing one into the next, into the next, into the next. Right? As opposed to certain other books in Tanakh, which feel more like the Grapes of Wrath, where you know something is going to happen, but it's going to take a while to get there. Not the Book of Ruth. This, and then this, and then this, and then this. Those who had to read the Grapes of Wrath in high school know exactly what I'm talking about. I don't know if that's a thing in Canada, though. But that's one reason why it's such a remarkable book to read and to learn. Another reason, it's so well told. I brought you in source number 3 from Professor Meltzer's introduction to the Dat Mikra edition of Ruth, where he talks about the ways in which this story has all the elements that literary scholars want to see in a good story. The balance of the parts of the story, the suspense elements, the surprise in certain elements of it, the tension, is this going to happen, is that going to happen, the remarkable figures who you have. It's such a great story. And then I brought you one other quote, because I love this quote. Ever since I first saw it, I've been quoting it. Take a look at source number 4 from Professor Phyllis Tribble, from an article called Two Women in a Man's World, a reading of the Book of Ruth. She says, a man's world tells a woman's story in the Book of Ruth. With consummate artistry, the Book of Ruth presents the aged Naomi and the youthful Ruth as they struggle for survival in a patriarchal environment. These women bear their own burdens. They know hardship, danger, insecurity, and death. No God promises them blessing, right? Meaning Hashem never speaks to them in the book. Hashem never says, I'm going to take care of you, right? Sometimes you like to compare Ruth to Abraham and Lech Lecha, traveling to a land, abandoning her family, but Abraham has a promise. No one promises anything to Ruth. No man rushes to their rescue. They themselves risk bold decisions and shocking acts to work out their own salvation in the midst of the alien, the hostile, and the unknown. And of course, Boaz will eventually rescue Ruth. But Ruth has to act in order to get there. One female has chosen another female in a world whose life depends on men. There is no more radical decision in all the memories of Israel. Isn't that a great line? Isn't that just a fantastic observation? I think that there's a lot to be said about that. There's more. But what I want to do this evening is to discuss a question about where this book is in Tanakh. Often, a question like that is considered academic, irrelevant to most people. Who cares? It's in Tanakh. Let's read the story. But I don't think so in this case. I think this is a really, really important question, because I think Ruth is in the wrong place in Tanakh. And you'll see what I mean. I'm going to unpack that. And the lesson involved in where it appears is vital in shaping our understanding of the book. Like I said, I'm glad to have this opportunity to discuss this. It emerged from certain ideas that came up in my weekly class on the Book of Ruth, and I wanted a chance to express them in a standalone lesson. If you get a chance to read the Yeshiva University Shavuot to Go, I put a little brief digest of this in there, but this is a more full explanation of it, and frankly, with shul attendance capped, I'm not sure how many people are going to be getting copies of the Shavuot to Go. You can download it. But here we go. We begin by asking the simple question. When did Ruth take place? When did the Book of Ruth happen, historically? This is a softball. Like, this isn't the hard... We're going to get to the harder ones. Shoftim, right? The era of the judges. The Jews come in from the wilderness into Israel. They have 28 years during which they are led by Joshua. Joshua dies. And then you have the period of the Shoftim, the period of the judges, all the way until the era of King Saul and then King David. Well, that was easy. The era of the Shoftim. Saying it's in the period of the Shoftim is something like saying that an event took place sometime between, the invention of the printing press and landing man on the moon. The era of the Shoftim lasts about 400 years, folks. Like, in the era of the Shoftim, we gotta do better than that. We have to be able to come up with a more accurate date than the period of the Shoftim. But we can't, because that's basically what we know. The book says, Bimei Shefot HaShofetim, in the time when the Shofetim were leading or judging, however you want to translate the word Shofet, that's its own discussion. But if you take a look on your sheet, you'll see source number 5. Source number 5 is a Midrash, Rut Rabbah, in which it is suggested that this occurred the period of Barak and Devorah. Devorah was known as a Shofet. Barak was the general she charged with leading the Jews in a war against Canaan. So the two of them, Barak and Devorah, are viewed as Shoftim. And this is the period of the Shoftim. And then it's also noted in the same source that you had Shamgar and Ehud, who had some overlap there during that period. So you have multiple Shoftim. So therefore, I could argue that this book of Ruth takes place in the era of Devorah, in the era of Barak. And that's one answer. It's a reasonable answer. It's an okay answer. Makes it fairly early during that period. Professor Meltzer notes that that would actually fit well with the Gemara, which says that Ruth was the granddaughter of Eglon, king of Moab, because he lived very early in the period of the judges. So you can fit that all together early on in the timeline. However, the Talmud has a different view. The Talmud in source number 6 says no. It says that Boaz was none other than a judge or leader by the name of Ivtzan. Ivtzan is late in the period of the Shoftim. The last Shofet, the last leader to be mentioned in the book of Shoftim is Shimshon, Samson. Ivtzan is about 20 years earlier. So way towards the end of this 400 year or so period is when this book takes place. A lot of discussion about how we know he's Ibtzan, not our discussion right now. Malbim actually in source number 7 places the story even later. He says it was during the period at the end of the era of the Shoftim. That's his view. But what we know from this is somewhere in a 400 year period called the period of the judges is when this book takes place. Okay? So far, so good? We're good. Okay. We're going to come back to the question of when exactly in the book it took place shortly. But that's one piece. Other question. Who wrote the Book of Ruth? Anybody know? Okay, good. Then I get to say something. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 8, passage in the Talmud, Shmuel, the prophet Shmuel wrote his book, meaning Shmuel, as well as the book of Shoftim, as well as the book of Ruth. Okay? Shmuel wrote the book of Shoftim, the book of Shmuel, and the book of Ruth. Well, now I have all the pieces in place for my questions. Tell me something. Shmuel, what do we know about him? What's the most important thing to know about the prophet Shmuel? He anointed the kings. Very, very true. He anoints Shaul, and then he anoints David. His mother is Chana. I think that's pretty important. Yesterday was Mother's Day.
After the judges, he was born after
the judges. He's actually the last of the judges himself. And Claudette moves us towards the key point here. He is the last of the judges. He is also a prophet. I would have expected that if a prophet writes a book, it's going to end up in the part of Tanakh which is devoted to the prophets. Like his other two books. He wrote the book of Shoftim. That book made it into Nevi'im, the part of Tanakh that is for prophecy. He wrote the book of Shmuel. That ended up in the part of Tanakh that is devoted to prophecy. And yet, the book of Ruth doesn't make it there. The book of Ruth is in the third part of Tanakh, the section we call Ketuvim, the writings, which are generally considered to have less sanctity than Nevi'im. If I have a book on my table of the prophets, and I have a book of the Ketuvim, the writings, the book from the prophets goes on top. It's considered to be of greater Kedusha, of greater holiness, of greater sanctity. So I don't understand. He had two books that made it into the prophets. Shmuel is not just any prophet either. On the hierarchy of prophecy, who's the greatest prophet we know of? Moses, right? Moshe, and basically there is no number two to Moshe, right? Moshe's in a league all by himself. So let's take Moshe out of the picture. Who's the next greatest prophet? Shmuel. Shmuel is considered Rabban Shel Nevi'im. Shmuel is, after Moshe, the greatest prophet we ever had. Outranks anybody else you can mention. So why is it that this book didn't end up among the prophecies that are recorded, that he recorded? This book belongs in Navi. That's question number one. And then and by the way, you could just say, well, maybe this book was written with lesser sanctity. Maybe that's the answer. He wrote this book with lesser sanctity, but that just pushes the question. So, okay, why did he write it with lesser sanctity? When I discussed this in the Shir for B'nai Torah, when I was filling in there, somebody said, because it's about a woman. I don't buy it. I think that there's a better explanation to be had. But let me ask now my other question, which is, if Shmuel wrote both the book of Shoftim and the book of Ruth, and they both occurred in the same time frame, why don't you make Ruth part of Shoftim? Right? I spent like 5 minutes trying to figure out when in the book of Shoftim the book of Ruth took place. Was it in Devorah's period? Was it in Ibsan's period? Towards the beginning? Towards the end? You know what would have solved that, really? Just put it in the book of Shoftim. Why did it need to be a standalone book? You could have solved the problem. Why? I mean, did Shmuel have a three-book deal? That, like, he has to produce three books, so he said, all right, let me break this one out, and it'll be its own thing. It's not longer than some of the other units in Shoftim. Shimshon's story gets 4 chapters also. Gidon's story gets 3 chapters. Why? Yeah, you can stick Ruth in there. I mean, it's not such a long book. Why is this its own book? It's such a strange thing, and it could have helped us clarify when the event happened. So those are my two big questions. My first question, why is this story in Ketuvim in the later part? And my second question, which honestly of the two bothers me even more, why did Shmuel break this out to be its own story? We don't normally do things like that. If you look in Tanakh, we don't normally take a story that belonged in one book and make it its own thing. Unless there's a reason, which I'm going to suggest there is, because otherwise we spent, 20 minutes building up questions without answers. That wouldn't be nice. So I do have an answer for both of those questions. In order to answer these questions, we need to understand what the goal was, what the purpose was of writing and canonizing Megillat Ruth. Why is this story in Tanakh at all? So I'll ask you a question. In general, why do stories make it into Tanakh? What determines whether a story, whether a prophecy, is going to make it into Tanakh?
Well,
an eternal lesson. Sorry, Stuart, you were going to say? Same thing?
We said the same thing. The lesson
okay. Yeah, there's a lesson to be learned. Exactly. Take a look at source number 9 on the sheet, please. I'm going to put the link in the chat again in case anyone joined after the last time I put it in, because I don't remember. So take a look at source number 9. The Gemara in Megillah says, many prophets stood for the Jewish people. Double the number of Jews who left Egypt. We've had so many prophets like you wouldn't believe. But prophecy which was needed for the generations was recorded. Prophecy which was not needed was not recorded. If there is a prophecy in Tanakh, it has to say something to us. So that you have some books which are dedicated to showing how God deals with the Jewish people. Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings, right? Some of them offer a direct exhortation to the listener, saying, you should be loyal to God, right? Yeshaya, Isaiah, Yirmiyah, Jeremiah, Yechezkel, much of Treyasar. Some of them describe a messianic time with hope for what's going to come. Yeshaya does that, Yechezkel does that, Daniel does that. Some of them offer guidance for our behavior, right? Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, Mishlei, Proverbs. There are goals for the books that are in Tanakh. Abarbanel says, Divrei Hayamim, Chronicles, is there in Tanakh in order to teach loyalty to the house of David. That's what that book is for. So what's the goal in canonizing Ruth? It's a nice story, but what are we supposed to get out of it? I'll ask you, surely you've heard this question discussed before. What's the goal of canonizing Ruth? Claudette, I'm going to ask you to hold off because you and I have discussed this topic before. Someone tell me, what's the goal of canonizing this very nice, pleasant 85-sentence story?
That kindness and loyalty have rewards.
Excellent. I'm going to come back to that, but since you said it, take a look quickly at source number 15, Medrash in Ruth Rabbah. Rabbi Zeira said, for each of the sources, I'm just reading out my English translation, but you can see the Hebrew as well. Rabbi Zeira said, this Megillah does not contain impurity and purity, prohibition and permission. It's not a book of laws. And there are some laws in it, but it's not a book of laws. It is written only to teach you the great reward for those who practice chesed. You do good things to other people, you get rewarded, right? As opposed to some other books in Tanakh where that doesn't show up so clearly. But yes, that's one idea. I'm going to come back to that one. What else?
How we should treat the converts, how we should respect them and treat them like a Jew.
Good. Positive treatment towards the stranger who joins us. I would put that under the heading of chesed in general, because it's teaching me kindness to everyone. One thing that you might want to follow up with on that, because I think it's fascinating as a question, is what exactly was going on in Boaz's fields? If you read chapter 2 carefully, you find that he needs to warn the people working in the fields, hey, be nice to her, don't shame her, don't yell at her. Like, dude, what was going on in your fields all the time? And why does only Ruth get that treatment? So there's much more to be said about that and about the treatment of the stranger, something worth exploring in that light. What else? There's at least one other very popular explanation that's given for why we have Ruth in Tanakh. It has to do with the very end of the book.
The genealogy.
So we know the ancestry of David.
Right, the ancestry of David, the genealogy of David, exactly. So that we will know where David came from. Well, I'm going to take these ideas that we've said and add a little bit to it and give it some structure. I'm going to show three different approaches to why this book is in Tanakh. First approach is that it's meant to support King David by validating the monarchy. And that has two elements. One element, like was just said, straight lineage. Because David needs us to validate his lineage because of Ruth. Meaning, I brought you on the sheet in source number 10, the verse from Dvarim, from Deuteronomy, Ammonite and Moabite shall not enter the congregation of God. Even the 10th generation of theirs shall not enter the congregation of God ever, for they did not greet you with bread and water when you were leaving Egypt. They hired Bilam, son of Beor, against you, right? This goes back to the end of the 40 years in the wilderness. The Jews are trying to get into the land. They're situated across the Jordan on the eastern side, south. And they're working their way north, trying to find a way that they can cross the Jordan to get in. And they hit Moab, and Moab is not only not interested in letting them through, as recorded in the beginning of Devarim, that's where we get this this story, but also, in Bamidbar we learn, they hire Bilam to curse the Jews. That's the story there. They're far from giving us bread and water. They are our cousins, and they are not helpful in the least, and therefore you can't marry a Moabite. Mind you, they can convert to Judaism, but they can't marry. That's where they're stuck. They can marry another Moabite who converts to Judaism, but they can't marry others. So they so that creates a problem, because Ruth marries Boaz, and their great grandson is David. And I'm not going into the whole discussion, but I brought you a piece of it in source number 11, in which when David kills Goliath, Doeg, lead advisor for King Saul, for Shaul, tries to raise challenges to David's lineage and to say he's illegitimate. And so this book says, no. Ruth marries Boaz, who is a leading figure in his day. It's all on the up and up. And Shmuel, by recording this, is testifying that that's okay. Why is it okay? Because she was a Moabite, a female Moabite, and the decree was only against the males. The males are the ones who are responsible for not coming out to greet you. The females are not responsible. That's a big, big topic in its own right. But as I underlined in source number 11, it is Shmuel who is the one who is the source. Right here in the book of Ruth, we see it. He is the source for the statement that you're not, that Ruth is okay, and therefore David is okay. So that, if you take a look at source number 12, Rabbi Avraham ibn Ezra, in his introduction to the book of Ruth, says, because David is the root of Israelite monarchy, David's lineage was recorded in the holy texts. Rabbi Yeshua Bachrach, in source number 13, expands upon it and says that this was essentially Shmuel's parting gift to David, was to legitimize him with the book of Ruth. So one way to look at why the book of Ruth is in Tanakh is that it's meant to insulate David against charges that there's something wrong with his lineage. But stronger than that is a second idea proposed by Dr. Yael Ziegler. She's written a ton on Megillat Ruth, and she has the following suggestion. It's not just about cementing the proper monarchy as coming from David, who has good lineage, but it's about the character of those figures in the lineage. It's about the character shown by Boaz, and more about the character shown by Ruth. The idea is, take a look at my translation of source number 14. One may say, I'm jumping the first part of her sentence here because it won't make sense until we go a little bit further, but go to where she says, by this read, in the end of the second line in my translation. The goal of Megillat Ruth is to justify the purity of David's lineage, accomplishing this by detailing the way that Ruth, the Moabite woman of this story, exemplified chesed, generosity, and involved herself in consistent and selfless giving to others. It is correct that Ruth's self-nullification is not something Judaism demands of every Jew, but it is a clear requirement when speaking of our leader. Not only do we expect this from our leader, but it is a prerequisite for establishment of the monarchy. Without Ruth at the helm, without someone who is equipped to give in a clear and selfless way to others, the monarchy is not a promise of vision of plenty, but a dangerous threat, a terrifying future, a recipe for lawlessness, corruption, and tyranny, right? I mean, we see that, because that happens with kings, right? In Tanakh and beyond. That's the corruption that comes with monarchy. Her point is to say, by bringing this book, you're showing what you need in a David, what you need in a monarch, because if you don't have it, you're going to have a disaster. That's the message of the book. It legitimizes David as a moral source for monarchy. Just to add to that, anybody remember the story of how it is that Moshe earned the right to be leader of the Jews, take them out of Egypt? Remember the story the Medrash tells? What's the story? It's a Medrash in Shmos Rabbah. Yeah, he's looking after, as the Torah says, he is herding the sheep out in the wilderness. Says the Medrash, what in the world are you doing herding sheep in the wilderness? You should herd the sheep where there's water. You know, you should herd the sheep where there's grass. So the answer is that there's this sheep that runs away, and he picks up the sheep, and he carries it, and God says, that's the one. That's the one. You find similar ideas with David as well in terms of his qualifications. Rav Meshulam David Soloveitchik, who passed away last year, wrote in the, it's recorded in the Haggadah of Brisk, that God picks leaders not based on how they do in the major moments, but how they deal with the little things. That's what qualifies them. So we're looking for a leader like that. As a matter of fact, I think I brought it on the sheet, did I? No, I did not bring it on the sheet. The Gemara in Yevamos says that King David said you need three traits in order to be a Jew. These are three traits that a Jew has to have in order to be a Jew. What are those traits? Anybody know? Three traits by which we are known. I'll give you the first one. Rachmanim. Bayshanim and Gomlei Chasadim. Right? Rachmanim, you have to be merciful. Bayshan, you have to be modest. And Gomel Chesed, you have to be generous. All three traits which are identified with Ruth. Right? David's talking about his great-grandmother. So the but that's your first understanding of what this book is for. This book is meant to support King David as monarch by showing his legitimacy and by showing the character of his ancestors. Second school of thought. This book is about showing divine justice, and as Stuart said before, about showing that God rewards kindness. Plays out in the book very, very clearly. Professor Meltzer in the Da Mikra edition supports this theme very nicely. He points out the word chesed, generosity, shows up over and over again in Ruth. In chapter 1, sentence 8, Naomi thanks Ruth for the chesed she did in Moab. In chapter 2, sentence 20, Naomi thanks God for helping the family with chesed. In chapter 3, sentence 10, Boaz thanks Ruth for her chesed to Naomi. Also, this book consistently emphasizes God's supervision for things. Take a look at source number 16, please. Professor Meltzer notes, the entire Megillah flows with faith in God and in the certainty of his oversight over his world. Seven times Naomi expresses this faith in the first two chapters. From when she says, first, God has taken care of his nation, ending the famine, to when she says, blessed be God who did not abandon his chesed. It's really nice to read the book of Ruth. It's a book that has no faith problems. It's so divorced from, like, real life. Like, everything is great. You do good things and good things happen to you. Isn't that awesome? But that's what this book is meant to show. Ruth and Boaz, the two people who extend great generosity towards others, end up marrying and living happily ever after. Well, except in the Medrash that Boaz, you know, dies a day later. Fine. But living happily for the rest of their lives. There's so much seen in this book about God rewarding good people. It even fits the real estate test, so to speak, in the book. Which items get the most real estate in the book, if you were to look back at the outline? Ruth's chesed to Naomi, right? The harvest. The Ruth going to Boaz in the granary and Boaz saying, I'll take care of you. Those are what gets the real estate in the book, and God responds. Professor Meltzer notes, I brought it in source number 17, that whereas in the book of Esther, God is preactive, God moves everything into place before the event happens, in the book of Ruth, God responds to things. Ruth does good things, God takes care of her. It's an after type of a thing. God is reacting. So that's one way to look at it. It's divine justice rewarding people for their kindness. The other note is that it shows that God takes care of people who display faith in God. It's sort of the antidote for Job. Here you have somebody who loses everything, right, Naomi and Ruth, and does not rebel, but instead returns back to Israel and is rewarded. Again, what a nice story. Okay, so our first way to understand this book is that it's validating, legitimizing King David. Our second approach is it's teaching us about divine reward for good behavior, whether that behavior is chesed or behavior is faith. And then I want to add one more element before we come back and show how this answers our questions. I see a third dominant theme in this book, and it explains a lot about it. And that is the theme of loyalty and betrayal. Where do we see betrayal in the book? Who betrays somebody in the book of Ruth?
Elimelech.
Right, Elimelech. Elimelech's family abandoning Beit Lechem. Right? Apparently they still have wealth. Malaya halachti, they left with a lot of stuff. Right? Claudette, what were you going to say?
The one that was supposed to marry Ruth.
Right, Ploni Almoni. Ploni Almoni was supposed to marry Ruth, and he says, I'll take a pass. Right? Admittedly, Boaz is happy about that, but still, that's not good behavior. That's betrayal of a responsibility. Elimelech's sons, right? Mahlon and Kilion, when they marry Moabite women. We're going to talk more about that in you know, very shortly, but that's an act of betrayal. On the other hand, the bulk of the book is loyalty. God is described as being loyal to the Jews by ending the famine. No one in this book blames God for bringing the famine. They all credit God with remembering his nation and ending the famine. Ruth and Orpah are loyal to Naomi by staying with her when their husbands die. Ruth and Orpah are loyal trying to stay with Naomi when coming back to Beit Lechem. Ultimately, she convinces Orpah to leave. Ruth is loyal in going to glean in order to support Naomi. She doesn't say, Naomi, you come along with me. The farmers are loyal by supporting the needy. God is loyal to Naomi's family, leading them to food with Boaz. Boaz is loyal towards Ruth in the field. He says to her, I saw what you did for Naomi, and I am going to provide you with plenty. Boaz marries Ruth. Loyalty after loyalty after loyalty after loyalty. And the reason I stress this is because loyalty and betrayal are a very important theme in Tanakh. If you read the book of Judges, there's a ton about betrayal. Devorah writes her poem about the war that she led with Barak against Canaan, and all about the tribes that didn't join in, that didn't support the effort. The Shimshon, right, is a whole story about, on the one hand, his loyalty to God, and on the other hand, the betrayals in which he engages and others engage. The books of Shmuel and Malachim, Samuel and Kings, David's loyalty to Saul, Saul's betrayal of David, the loyalty of others to David, the many, many layers of betrayal that go on in his family and among his generals, the books of Isaiah, Jeremiah, loyalty and betrayal in our relationship with God and in our national existence. Loyalty and betrayal are major dominant themes in Tanakh, and particularly at the time of canonization of Tanakh. We are taught that Tanakh is canonized by the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the Great Assembly, in the beginning of the Second Temple period. That's a time when there is a particular concern for one type of betrayal. Take a look, please, at source number 18. Verses from the second chapter of Malachi. Malachi, who is considered to have been a member of that Great Assembly that canonized Tanakh. He complains, "Have we not all one Father? Has not one God created us? Why do we deal treacherously, every man against his brother, to profane the covenant of our fathers?" He's talking about a very specific betrayal, as you'll see. "Yehuda has dealt treacherously. A disgusting thing has been done in Yisrael and in Yerushalayim. For Yehuda has profaned the holiness of the Lord, which he loved, has married the daughter of a strange god." It is a betrayal, specifically, that the Jews have taken Canaanite wives. That's the issue. The Jews who came back from Babylon under Cyrus of Persia have come back to the land and have married others not from the Jewish people. And that's a grave concern, not just for Malachi, but in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah as well. It's a concern in this period, in the Second Temple period, and what you're seeing in the story in the book of Ruth is all about that. Right? Because that's what Mahlon and Kilion did. And then Ruth reverses it. So what you have here is a lesson in loyalty and its rewards and betrayal and its rewards. It even shows the fulfillment of Malachi's prediction. It says, as it continues in number 18, the Lord will cut off from the man that does this all living offspring from the tents of Yaakov. Right? That's the warning, which plays out in the book of Ruth with Mahlon and Kilion. Painful stuff. So to summarize the purposes of writing and canonizing the book of Ruth, we now understand it legitimizes King David and shows the character needed for a king. It shows God rewarding people for chesed and for faith. And it teaches us in general about loyalty and betrayal. And it does it all through a story. Right? Unlike many of the books of the prophets, I've got Isaiah yelling all day long about loyalty and betrayal and bad behavior and all of that. He doesn't tell stories. You have a little bit of a section with some stories in the 30s, in the somewhere on chapter 32 to 39 or so. But overall, you don't. So why is the book of Ruth not in Nevi'im? Why is it not in the prophets? So I brought you Don Isaac Abarbanel in source number 19. Don Isaac Abarbanel writes an introduction to the book of Joshua, the book of Yoshua, in which he talks about the collection and canonization of Tanakh. And this is his explanation. You can see my translation there, the top of the last side. And because Shmuel did this himself, Shmuel decided, he says, to write the book himself in David's honor and to tell of his lineage without any divine command. And he did not communicate what he wrote here from God prophetically, but according to knowledge that was accepted with them, our sages accepted that it was written with divine inspiration, but not with prophecy. Therefore, they placed it among the writings according to the level of inspiration with which they believed it was composed. His first explanation, and somebody wrote this to me in the chat earlier, is that the book is not in the prophets because it's not a prophecy. It was a recording of historical traditions. That's his first explanation, but it doesn't really help because, again, as I asked before, if it's just a recording of historical traditions, why didn't he write it prophetically? Why didn't God say it? We think it's worth putting in. He's certainly capable of it. He's Shmuel. So look at his second explanation. And I have a second reason, he says. Abarbanel never has enough with one reason, which is that even if we would agree that Ruth was on the level of the book of Judges and that it was composed prophetically, upon divine command and via divine information like the other books of the prophets. Still, Shmuel's intent with this composition was David's honor, as I have written, and therefore our sages saw fit to join it with the book of Psalms, which David wrote to inform him of his lineage. It really could have been in the prophets, but better to put it in the writings, so that way it'll go along with Tehillim, with Psalms, which we credit so much of Psalms to David. Not only that, he points out, the Gemara in Bava Basra gives you the order of the books in Ketuvim, in the writings, and it puts Ruth, Tehillim, then Job, and so on. Not the way our Tanakh is structured. So he says, you know why? Because it's supposed to go there. You want the story of the lineage of David next to Psalms. Okay, it's a nice explanation. But I think that I would offer, based on what we've said, that it makes a lot of sense for this to be in Ketuvim. Because it's really more pedagogic story than a normal prophetic divine message from God, which generally includes, as I said, a more direct instruction. It's teaching us all sorts of lessons about the monarchy of King David, about our relationship with God, about loyalty and betrayal, but it's doing it all via a story. So that's number one. Number two, though, and this is my focus, this is the question that I really like. Why is it not in Shoftim? Why didn't you tell the story in Shoftim? Shoftim has stories. Why isn't it there in Shoftim? So Abarbanel offers us two explanations. Take a look, please, at source number 20. You know we're at the end, because that's source number 20, it's the last one on the sheet. But Megillat Rut was not recorded in the Book of Judges, and was not counted among the prophets, because the Book of Judges was designated first and foremost for broad stories which occurred to Israel and their judges in those days, from the time of Yahushua, the time of Joshua, until Shmuel's birth. He says, it's not there, because Shoftim is about national stories. This is a family. We want national stories in Shoftim. Meh. There are personal stories in Shoftim also. It's all how you look at it. And we're making this story about the Davidic dynasty, which is national. So, not so sold. But that's okay, because again, he's a Barbanel. He's got more than one reason. And because when Shmuel prepared Megillat Rut, his writing of the Book of Judges was already complete. So he made Ruth its own scroll. Anybody convinced by that idea? Anyone buying that one? He was already done writing Shoftim. So he made this one its own book. Are you serious? Shmuel doesn't have the option of just putting this into the book. I don't even understand how he wrote that with a straight face. It doesn't hold water. That's not why it's not in Shoftim. Tell me something. I didn't think of doing this in advance, or I would have done it as a formal poll where everybody could answer anonymously. But how many people here have learned the Book of Shoftim, the Book of Judges, on some level, even just reading it? Okay, I see a bunch of hands, fair number of hands. Tell me something. What would you say is the theme of the Book of Shoftim? If you had to capture Shoftim in one word, what would it be?
Evil.
Chaos. Yeah. Chaos. Those are good words. What else? Any others? Shoftim is such a depressing book, right? It's a spiral. You may have heard the classic Shoftim spiral. Jews do bad things. God gives them over into the hands of the enemy. The enemy harms them, punishes them. The Jews cry out to God. God sends them a shofet. Sometimes those aren't in the same order. Sometimes there's the shofet and then they cry out. And then he saves them and then they continue to sin. And then God hands them over. And it just goes down and down and down. And the image is very much that. It's just Shoftim is a book of depression. It's the Jews lack a central authority to guide them to Torah, and so they sink into Canaan-style barbarity. It's about things that go wrong. My word for Shoftim, my one word that captures the book, is failure. Rabbi Yosef Gabriel Bechhofer wrote a commentary to Shoftim called Big Day Sheish. And he has a line in his introduction, which I like to quote, my English translation of it. No book in Tanakh expresses failure like the Book of Shoftim. Whatever can go wrong, will go wrong. You have a Shofet who kills 69 out of his 70 half-brothers in order to take command. And the only reason he doesn't kill the 70th is because he doesn't succeed in getting to him. Right? I have a Shofet who's supposed to be a Nazir, and empowered with incredible strength by God, who can't stop getting involved with Philistine women, and whose major, major heroic act costs him his life, right? That being Shimshon. I mean, it's just, these stories are so abysmal for the Shoftim and for the nation as a whole. Consider this. Naomi Elimelech and her family start out the book in what city? What's the name of the city?
Beit Lechem.
Beit Lechem, right. They go to Moab and then they come back to be in Beit Lechem. The city of Beit Lechem shows up twice in the Book of Shoftim. And technically, it also shows up as the city that the Shofet Ivtzan is from, but we don't get any events there. There are two events that involve Beit Lechem. The first one is Pesel Nicha, right, in which there is a Levi from the city of Beit Lechem who goes to serve as a priest for some kind of quasi-idol in the house of Micha. My Levi from Beit Lechem becomes a Kohen, a priest for idolatry. That's one. The other story, the Pilegesh Begiv'ah, the concubine from Beit Lechem who gets raped and murdered, triggering a civil war. Those are my two stories of Beit Lechem. That's what we're talking about there. Take that on one side and ask yourself, how well would the Book of Ruth have fit in Shoftim? That would have stuck out like 100 sore thumbs. It's a completely opposite message. It's a completely opposite book. Where Shoftim is a book of failure, Ruth is a book of hope. It's a book of aspiration. It teaches us what monarchy can look like. Here are traits of Ruth and Boaz that are going to inform the monarchy, like Dr. Ziegler had wrote. Your monarchy can be of generosity and giving. It teaches us that God rewards people who behave nicely. You act with chesed towards others. You take in the stranger. You act with faith in God. God's going to take care of you. You're going to get a happy ending. Your loyalty matters. Betrayal is going to get punished. Machlon and Kilion and Ploni Almoni, who doesn't even get his name in the book. He's just John Doe, right? Whereas, if you act with loyalty, you'll be taken care of. You'll be rewarded. The book of Shoftim and the book of Ruth may happen at the same time, but they live in different universes. Their messages are diametrically opposite. Whether Ruth is happening in the beginning of the book of Shoftim or whether it is happening in the end of the book of Shoftim doesn't matter, because it's the opposite of Shoftim altogether. Shoftim teaches despair. Ruth elevates us with hope. So that my hope is that as we celebrate Shavuot next week and we read Megillat Ruth, we will absorb the story and absorb the lessons it teaches. The lessons of generosity and leadership. The lessons of divine reward for generosity and for loyalty to Hashem. The messages of betrayal on the one hand and loyalty on the other. And absorb them for ourselves. Take them as lessons for how we conduct ourselves. And God willing, we will also merit that happy ending that you see in Megillat Ruth, and ultimately the restoration of the House of David. Thank you very much.